One of the things I thought I might begin with today that'll kind of help you see where I'm going is we need mind and heart. We need both of them. The Christian tradition is committed to understanding. Catechesis was so important in the early church. Nowadays, we call it discipleship. It's very important that we understand what God's up to in salvation and who he is and who we are. We need the Bible for that. So the mind plays an essential role in the healing of the soul and in the redemption of the soul. What I'm arguing for is that the Bible teaches us that as important as the mind is, the heart is more important because there's more important features of the soul that are going on down there. And that, unfortunately, in the modern era, mainstream psychology and mainstream philosophy, as well as much of Christianity, has prioritized the mind as being more important than anything else. And if you educate, you cure our problems. Education is, in modern culture, considered to be the way to heal society and to change people. And I think sometimes in the church we have assumed much the same. But what I'm saying is that we need both. I think there are some versions of Christianity, just as there are some versions of mainstream culture, that have basically ignored the heart and not paid attention to it, just focused on the mind. That's not going to work from a Christian standpoint. We need both. But I'm going even further and saying we need both, but what we want to do is prioritize the heart over the mind. We need both, but the mind is where the focus of the new creation is directed, and the mind is a pathway to get into the heart so that we can bring healing there, reorganize things down there, so that our hearts will become more and more after God's own heart. One dear sister here brought that scripture out to me this morning. How wonderful that a phrase that is, that David was a man after God's own heart. And that's what God's after, because that's where character formation and spiritual formation is. Okay? So what I'd like to do, just as a kind of another reminder of how important the heart is in the Christian tradition, is to just look at some of these great passages from church history. We're all familiar with I think it's on the first or second page of Augustine's Confessions. The heart is restless, O Lord, until it finds its rest in you. I hope you experienced a little more rest this morning with that reading that we did. That's what I found, that reminder. And surely Augustine was referring in some respect to when Jesus said, "Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." And rest is such an important theme in the Bible, going back to the Sabbath rest, of course. And then Martin Luther, pointing us to idols of the heart. Anything on which your heart relies and depends, I say, that is really your God. And so we're always, you know, on the lookout for idols of the heart. It's one of the great emphases of the biblical counseling movement. Here's a favorite of mine from Pascal. The heart has its reasons, which reason did not know. Pascal is a really important figure in what some Christians have called the heart tradition of Christianity, going back to Augustine and really into Paul and David, you know, in the Bible. But Pascal, you know, was a genius in thinking with rationality. I mean, he was a mathematician and a scientist in his day. But he had a profound understanding of the difference between mind and heart. and recognizing that the heart has a certain priority in the Christian faith. The heart has its reasons, which reason cannot understand. And here's another one that I think I'm going to make reference to somewhere else. It is the heart which experiences God and not reason. Isn't that interesting? Reason cannot experience God. Reason is reason. It does what it does really well. We're thankful for reason. It accomplishes a lot of great things. But it doesn't experience God. We experience God in our hearts. And at best, reason can be a catalyst to a heartfelt aha moment with God. One of my favorite authors in the heart tradition is Max Scheler, a phenomenological philosopher around that wrote Ordo Amoris around 1914, I believe. And this Ordo Amoris is a phrase that you find in Augustine, the order of love, in contrast to the order of intellect. There are two orders to the soul. We couldn't say mind and heart, but you know, this is just a fancy Latin way of bringing out the distinction. But Max Scheler wrote, I think it's a 20-page article on the Ordo Amoris, where he describes the order of love of a person. And he says, where a person's heart is attached, there for him is the core of the so-called essence of things. And part of the journey of the Christian life is becoming familiar with your ordo amoris, which according to Scheler also includes our hate. What do you hate? What really ticks you off? You know, is it injustice, evil in the world, or evil in your own heart? Or is it when you're inconvenienced? You know, we all fall short of the glory of God. But our loves and our hates are a part of the topography of our souls. And according to the heart tradition, our challenge is to become experts in the lay of the land of our souls. And we can all go further in that journey than we have. And it's good to go there, to become an expert in the matters of the soul. And for one reason, because you will love better. And for me as a therapist, it's essential that I grow in that. But I would argue that, you know, being a therapist is just learning how to be a good friend with people. And all of us in that sense are called to become friends of one another more and more. And we become better friends as we come to know ourselves better, our souls better, so that we can help people with their souls. That's my understanding. And then Robert Roberts is a Christian philosopher still alive in our day. He is one of the great Christian philosophers in English, maybe of all time, but certainly living. And he's an expert in Soren Kierkegaard, who was one of the great Christian philosophers of all time. By the way, Francis Schaeffer didn't think so. Some of you are familiar with Schaeffer. And, you know, Schaeffer just didn't understand Kierkegaard. It's become sort of a truism since Schaeffer died that he misread Kierkegaard terribly. It's understandable because the first people to read Kierkegaard in the 20th century were liberals. And Schaeffer misunderstood why that happened. But since then, a lot of evangelicals have been reading Kierkegaard, like Robert Roberts, and realized, oh my goodness, he was one of the great Christian minds of all time. And he's, you know, European. Kierkegaard is considered the father of Christian psychology. He wrote a number of essays about Christian psychology. He called himself a Christian psychologist. The most important book of his, I think, that's none of his material is easy. I would say begin with a secondary source. I have found secondary sources to be so helpful in understanding him because he was just like too smart, you know, and it took him forever to say anything, you know, so I like reading secondary sources. As long as I'm talking about him, I might mention Robert Roberts has written a couple of great books on Kierkegaard. He just came out with probably his most important book on Kierkegaard, his understanding of moral character. It's pretty thick. Robert Roberts. I can't remember the title of the book, but you'll see it's a recent, just came out within the last year. It's something about character. But then the most important Christian author on Kierkegaard is C. Stephen Evans. He's written many books. He's considered probably the most important Kierkegaard scholar in our day. And he just came out with a book on Kierkegaard's spirituality that's really good. It's very accessible. Steve Evans is really readable. I love him because he brings things down to a place where I can understand them. But anyway, I was mentioning that his greatest Christian psychology work, Kierkegaard's greatest Christian psychology work, is called The Sickness Unto Death, which is a book about sin. It's the best book about sin ever written, in my opinion. And you can't have a Christian psychology without sin. Doesn't make sense, because sin is such a defining term for the human predicament, the human psychopathology. I teach my students that sin, there's a lot of kinds of psychopathology in the world. Schizophrenia, anxiety disorders, eating disorders. There's a lot of them that have been identified. But the worst psychopathology is sin, which everybody has that problem. But Christianity is a therapy specifically aimed at sin, healing us from sin. Anyway, this is Robert's definition of heart. Your heart is your inward self. I think he's trying to summarize the teaching in the New Testament about heart. Your personality, your actual you, and what you treasure. What's important to you, what you are centrally attached to, determines what that self is like. What you love is what you are. James K. Smith wrote a book recently. Within the last 10 years, you are what you love. That's summarizes that. Oh, there's a lot of things happening in our day that are bringing us to the heart, bringing us back to the heart. All right, I think that's it for my just some wonderful quotes of about the heart in the Christian tradition. So it's obvious that heart is important, I think, to Christianity and therefore to a Christian psychology. But what I want to suggest to mainstream psychology in our day is that you've neglected the heart to the detriment of the field of psychology in our day. And one piece of evidence that I'm going to share with you today a little bit is that in everyday speech, some of you mentioned this last night, in everyday speech, contemporary Westerners still frequently use the word heart in what are called various idioms, phrases that have heart in them that capture a certain kind of meaning. I'm going to use some English idioms. They might not make sense in your language, your first language, but I bet that every one of your first languages has its own set of idioms that use the heart. And there might be some similarities. There's a lot of overlap because of close cultural connection. But so one of them in English is I mean this from the bottom of my heart. Take heart, my friend. Don't give up. Take heart. Somebody mentioned this one before, follow your heart. Now, that can be really misused. If the person's in an adulterous situation and we say, just follow your heart, but there is, do you think, and I, you know, we haven't talked about this, and you might disagree with what I'm about to say, do you think that there might be a created wisdom that's built into the human condition that is also being appealed to with this phrase, follow your heart? Because deep down, you know what the right way is to go. Now, unfortunately, it's not infallible. The Bible's infallible. Our hearts are not infallible. But I have found, and maybe you have to some degree as well, that there is a created wisdom that all people have. I mean, John said some pretty amazing things in John, in the Gospel of John, but I believe it's, what verse is it? Verse 9 of chapter 1, that the Word, the Word of God, Jesus Christ, enlightens everyone. The Word enlightens everybody. The Reformed tradition calls that common grace. I like to call it creation grace. That God is always giving good things to everybody in the world, all the time. And part of that goodness is wisdom. Non-Christians have wisdom. We're foolish. We Christians are foolish if we can't see it. Now, of course, it's distorted. And the problem with non-Christian wisdom is it's distorted at the heart. So it's deeply compromised in a way that leads people away from God. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a moral wisdom, for example, in many non-Christians. Anyway, that's a truism. People say, I had a change of heart. She has a heart of gold. He lost heart and gave up on that project. He wears his heart on his sleeve. That's an unusual turn of phrase, but common in English. She has her heart set on going to college. We had a heart-to-heart conversation. He's heartbroken because he lost his job. So, English-speaking people continue to use the term heart to refer to a wide variety of psychological activities, suggesting that it's actually a very complex psychological concept. We would call it a lay psychological concept because it's not been developed in the scientific psychology of our day. But that's a problem of the scientific psychology of our day if it's not mapping onto the way we live our lives. And that's my point. And you know, one of the evidences of the way that I think a Christian psychology should be organized is, yesterday I said that the Bible gives us the first principles of life, but also the first principles of a Christian psychology. And one of the things that we have to see immediately is that the Bible was written in everyday language, not written in advanced philosophical or scientific terminology, which surely God could have written the most complicated Bible of all, you know, imaginable, right? With all kinds of esoteric and complex language and conceptual schemes that are far beyond our understanding. But why would he do that? You know, he gave us a Bible written in everyday language. And so a Christian psychology needs to be attuned to everyday life, taking seriously the way we live our lives. And that's one reason why I'm very interested in this, in the heart, because we use it, the term, commonly. So I want to talk a little bit with you this morning about lay. Yesterday we looked at biblical and Christian grounds for a psychology of the heart. And today I want to look with you at some lay and scientific grounds for a psychology of the heart. This is going to be a lot harder, and there's no way I can do justice to it. I'll just be honest with you. In part because I'm still working on it. I've just begun some research that I am long ways from finishing. This is kind of where I'm at today, you know, in May of 2022 with this study. I have a number of students who are helping me with it. I think it's interesting, and I just want to bring you along as best as I can into my world to understand what it is that I'm doing and why it's sort of difficult to make the case to a secular world of why a psychology of the heart is worthy of our attention. So this slide we saw yet last night, and it's just, again, three meanings: physical heart in my chest, psychological heart in my torso, and then the third use, a pure metaphor, is using the word heart as in it's at the heart of the argument. And all three of them are related to each other. It's called a metaphorical network in English, where you have these associations between these three uses of heart that are related to each other in everyday life. I did a Google search on the word heart beginning in 1500 up until 2019. And this is what you find with the use of heart in English over the last 500 years. So, and you know, part of it is based on you know, what's available in the Google world. You know, that's so it's biased by, you know, there are works that were written that didn't, you know, haven't been put into the metaverse yet. But what you find is that in the 1600s, a huge use of the word heart, far outstripping any time since. And this was a time of great Christian renewal. In England, it was called the Puritan Revolution. On the continent, it was referred to, at least in Holland, as the Second Reformation. And a lot of people used heart during this time. This is also when Pascal was writing. However, as the natural sciences made their inroad into Western thought, modernity, I would call it, modern philosophy, Descartes and Montesquieu and others, the use of the term heart goes down a bit, and then it starts to increase again in the 1700s, which was also a time of religious renewal, the Great Awakening, for example. And then in the 1800s, which is the movement known as late 1700s, early 1800s.
Jane Austen?
Yeah, she was a part of that. No, she was right at the heart of that. You know, it would be wonderful. Now I want to do a word search in Jane Austen, you know, because I hadn't thought of her yet, but I love her and she's great. And I bet she's got a lot of uses of the word heart in her works. I've never noticed them before, but that would be a great word search. I got one more task I have to do. But she was a part of a literary movement called Romanticism. Romanticism. It had an impact on poetry. Goethe was, you know, one of the great figures on the continent. It was also big in England, but and music. But there was a lot of use of the term heart, and then it started to decrease into the 1900s, which is, you know, this is, you know, the era of modern psychology, and then over the last 30 years, there's been an uptick in increase in use of the heart. But I've collected some data on Twitter. I've gathered did a search on the English word heart in Twitter and gathered 100,000 tweets over a total of 5 hours. It just took 5 hours of sifting to find 100,000 tweets. And this is a project that my students and I have just begun to go through it and to categorize all the uses of heart that we discover. And let me just see if I can find one. It really broke my heart. My heart is beating so fast. Now that's one where the first and second meanings are overlapping. It's about the physical heart, but it's related to the psychological heart. I can tell already that the second half will be heart in the mouth stuff. I don't know what that means exactly. And some of these will be hard to interpret, frankly. Anyway, each of them has the use of heart. And, you know, this is just within the last 6 months this data was collected. So it shows that in social media, the term heart is commonly used. And again, I'm going to use this as an argument for criticism of mainstream psychology, which has ignored a psychological construct that's very much in use in everyday life. And that brings me to another point that I don't have on my PowerPoint, but it's just, I mentioned it last night. It's just the symbol of heart that has become, you know, so common in our culture for the physical heart, but also for the emotional heart, for the heart, the psychological heart, that indicates something. I haven't analyzed it fully, but it's a powerfully common symbol that indicates prevalence, you know, of heart awareness in a way that modern psychology has not used. One of my favorite Christian philosophers in our day is a fellow named Charles Taylor. He's a Christian, and he's been critical of mainstream psychology for his whole career. One of the things he's been advocating is what he calls, if you're going to do psychology, you should come up with what he calls the best available account. And what he means by that is the best accounting of everyday life. And I'm very sympathetic to that approach to psychology. And so one of the subtexts of what my argument is in this part of the presentation is that modern psychology, because of its deference to the natural sciences, it has basically borrowed the methods of the natural sciences and assumed that that's the best way to understand human beings. But in the process, they have cut off psychology from some of the ways we live our lives. And it's really complicated, and I'm not sure I can make a very, very good argument today about my concern and how to address that fully, but I'm just letting you know that my goal as a Christian psychologist is I want to do justice to the way we live our lives, not I don't want to do a psychology that conforms to certain standards of scientific precision simply because they do that in physics. It may be helpful, and of course I believe that you know, mathematics and careful observation and statistics can be helpful, but only if they're subordinated to life lived in the real world. And you know, obviously there have been criticisms of mainstream psychology. We talked about a little bit last night, logotherapy, humanistic and existential psychology made that critique back in the 60s and 70s. But they got overwhelmed by the continuing pressure to conform to the natural sciences, and they lost most of their voice, I would say, except in psychotherapy. And I don't think, you know, right now it's possible to really fight that. That tidal wave has only grown in American psychology over the last 50 years. But I hang out in APA, the American Psychological Association, I hang out in the theoretical philosophical division. And those folks are happy to critique mainstream psychology, and they are, many of them are agreed that there's something wrong with the methodology of modern psychology that is distorting the field. I don't know if this would be helpful to any of you, but the currently in America among this group, the most popular way of describing their philosophy of science is calling it hermeneutic psychology, which is obviously big in Europe, bigger in Europe than it has been in the United States. But you know, Paul Ricoeur and Hans Gadamer were two of the leading figures of hermeneutic philosophy in the last half of the 20th century. And there's a group of psychologists that really believe that it's all about interpretation of language as the primary method for understanding, for developing psychology, rather than measurement and statistics. Not that they're against those, but just that they have to be subordinated to an understanding of language. And I'm in fundamental agreement with that in what I'm trying to do. This next section is where I'm most unsure about how much to go, how much detail to go into. I want to try a little bit to explain, to justify why modern psychology has neglected the heart, and also to explain why it's going to be difficult for me to make the case that we should attend to the heart to mainstream psychology, given their assumptions. So I think I touched on this last night. I didn't read through this paragraph, but research on the brain shows that most of what we are calling the heart happens in the brain, in the limbic system, or parts of the cerebral cortex that are dedicated to emotional and moral processing, in the prefrontal cortex especially. And therefore, nowhere near the physical heart or the torso. And another problem is that the activities associated with the mind are fairly easily accessible, comparatively. Consciousness, which is what we're aware of right now, memory, reason, and language, we can access those aspects of human psychology relatively easily. And it's the reason why modern psychology has accomplished a lot over the last 100 years in documenting these aspects of the mind. So it makes sense. You know, they've done a lot of good work in these areas. And you know, I want to concede that. Conversely, the activities associated with the mind are more difficult to study. The study of emotion, the study of desire. You know, the first book on desire that I'm aware of, at least in English, was published within the last 10 years, called The Psychology of Desire. And it's kind of mechanistic, as you might expect in American psychology, but at least they're talking about desire, which they had ignored for most of the 20th century, 21st century. But similarly, things like intuition has been very little studied, morality very little studied, and spirituality, although there's been more research on spirituality over that last 100 years than probably any other area because of the psychology of religion. But these are all areas that are harder to study. And that has prevented modern psychology from doing research on them. Gee, we talked about this last night. So when Stefan brought this to our attention, modern psychology studies processes and is loath to posit an entity like the mind and certainly like the heart. Now, I mentioned last night, the mind is used, but far more frequently are terms like intelligence or cognition, because those are processes. And for some reason, I think it's, you know, they haven't thought carefully enough about it. It's considered more legitimate to talk about a process than a structure or an entity, particularly an entity. As a result, the psychological heart is considered merely metaphorical. I mentioned that yesterday. Oh, and then you've seen that last night. Some of these are repetition. Now, we didn't talk about these. Wilhelm Wundt is the father of modern psychology. He's an interesting figure because while he started, he used natural science methods in the application of studying sensation and perception. I'm trying to remember what else he did, but it was quickly extended to memory and even action, volition. But he also, later in his career, he did a whole 10-volume set of studies on Volkspsychologie, folk psychology, lay psychology, where he studied what I'm studying. So he was not opposed to lay psychology, but he was he had a very rich view of psychology, and he believed that we needed to do psychology according to natural science methods, which he started in commonly considered the founding of modern psychology, 1879, in his laboratory in Leipzig. But then later in the 20th century, the next 20 years, he worked on this lay psychology. However, in 1912, in his book, An Introduction to Psychology, which has been translated into English, he says, the goal of psychology is to discover the facts of consciousness and its combinations and relations, the facts of consciousness. That was how he understood psychology. So it's very much about the mind, because the mind is identified often with conscious awareness, whereas the heart is something that's just outside of consciousness, but we can become aware of the heart if we attend to it. Anyway, this helps to explain the journey of modern psychology and ignoring the heart. William James is the father of American psychology, and he defines psychology as the science of mental life, study of the mind. And his student, E.L. Thorndike, just a little later, defined psychology as the science of mental facts or of mind. Now, behaviorism became an enormous force in American psychology for 30, 40 years, which, of course, ignored the mind. American psychology became so positivistic that it said we can't even the mind and mental facts are irrelevant for this for legitimate psychology. We're going to stick only to what observation and measurement can do in the physical world. So they basically took the methods of the natural sciences to their logical extreme. But by almost everybody's reckoning in Europe and in America now, we recognize that was a disaster. Maybe disaster is too strong a term to describe how modern psychology views that history, but nobody thinks that modern psychology should be dominated by the study of rats and pigeons or monkeys. Nobody thinks that anymore. Mainstream psychology says that's helpful, But nobody considers that should be the dominant approach. So in the 50s, a new movement came along that's been called the cognitive revolution. And this is where the mind came back to become the dominant focus of at least American psychology over the last 70 years. And I think it's fair to say that European psychology has followed suit, that now some great work has been done in Europe in cognitive psychology, and I'm not that aware of European psychology, but I'm aware that they've done a lot of work in action and volition, more so than in America. They kind of led the way, but using natural science methods in the study of action. Anyway, sorry if that's, you know, most of you are not interested in psychology, the science of psychology, but let me just bring us up to the last 10 years. David Myers and Nathan DeWall have written a very popular American psychology textbook where they define psychology as the science of behavior and mental processes. So we're, you know, I've just encapsulated 100 years of American psychology. And it even with allowing for behavior now is in the definition of psychology in, I think this was 2013, that definition, no, 2020, that definition was published. There's still a narrow definition of the psychology is the study of not the heart. That's my point. The last section of our time today is I'm going to go into cardative therapy and talk about what does it look like to do soul care on the heart. But before we get there, I'm just going to touch on, so I want to make a case for why modern psychology should pay attention to the heart. Reference to the psychological heart goes back to ancient cultures around the world. In early Egypt, before the Bible was written, words for heart were being used for the psychological heart. And of course, we find them in the Hebrew scriptures, which goes back a long ways. The heart is one of the four most important organs in Chinese medicine, leading to many psychological influences in China, evident in the way they do medicine and also their language system. Heart is a very important concept. As a result, the Mandarin word for the physical heart shows up in many Chinese ideographs. You know, the diagrams that they use for their language system, which possible for Westerners to understand unless we take Chinese. Many of them have embedded in them the word heart, as well as another word that together has a new meaning. Heart is very powerfully important in Mandarin. I have a few students, Chinese students, who are working on doing some research and collecting a lot of these ideographs as a way of documenting cross-cultural influence, not just in the West, that heart, psychological heart is important, but it's around the world, at least in Eastern cultures. I also want to do some research in Africa, because I think that would be really cool if we could find some evidence in African culture as well. Now, this is going to be kind of hard, but I want to see if I can make the case here. I was talking with our room monitor about the physical heart, because she's an eye doctor who does also collects data on blood pressure with her patients. And she just mentioned that she's aware that blood pressure is correlated with stress. She sees it with her patients, and this is commonly recognized in the medical field. The relationship between what we call the body and the soul is well documented in medicine, even though they technically don't agree that we have a soul. They don't have category for the soul, but they make reference to the mind is about the best that they come up with. But There are reasons for this association that we need to think carefully about, and I need to do more research on, because I don't really understand it very well. But the study of the human nervous system has understandably focused on the central nervous system. But the peripheral nervous system, which is scattered throughout the rest of our body, particularly the nerves located in our torso, around our heart, around our lungs, in our stomach area, in our digestive system, there are thousands of neurons in our torso, and there's a feedback system. Not only does our brain tell our digestive system when to work and when to shut off, but there's a lot of information from our torso going back into our brain, letting us know what's going on down there. Most of it we're not aware of. It's occurring in the autonomic nervous system. It's happening automatically. But nevertheless, there's a dialogue going on in our bodies that we can become more or less attuned to. There are 40,000 neurons associated with the heart that are recording information that we're aware of when our heart skips a beat, we say, or we experience a pain in our heart or a heaviness there. You know what I mean by that? But that's referring to something going on regarding our heart and the nerves that are attended to it, that are connected to the vagal nerve that communicates to our brain how we're doing. Well, what I'm trying to do right now is explain why we humans came up with this metaphor for the psychological heart. It's based in the physical heart. Neurocardiology has documented a close relationship between stress and heart attacks. Researchers have found that human well-being is correlated to heart function. There is, in fact, significant relation between both the physical and the psychological heart. Oh, heart ache syndrome is what I meant, not heartbroken syndrome. But there's something that you find in the medical literature of intense grief that occurs to somebody because of the loss of a spouse that results in depression after the loss of a spouse that you've been married to for 30, 40, 50 years. And within a year, statistically speaking, frequency of death of the spouse after the first spouse dies. And that's called the heartache syndrome. It's been identified in medical literature. That's about both the interaction between the physical heart and the psychological heart. Over the past 40 years, cognitive psychologists and cognitive linguists have documented the role of what they call embodied metaphors. Metaphors that flow out of our embodied experience in childhood. The words up and down are significant in at least the English language, and I think in all languages around the world. I'm pretty sure this has been documented by linguists around the world. Very simple, but up is good and down is bad. I'm feeling down. I'm feeling up today. Well, what's that about? Well, when you're 4 years old, everything is up and down. And being down is sad, but being up and picked up and carried and thrown up are good. And these are woven into our psychology because they're a part of our embodied experience in early childhood. Now, I'm just kind of telling you that, but there's been now dozens of books and hundreds of articles that have documented this important influence in human life. Jean Piaget, one of the great European psychologists of the 20th century, recognized that children in the first 2 years of life, their cognition is grounded in their sensory experience and their embodied movement, primarily because they haven't learned language yet and they can't form the kind of linguistically based concepts that we take for granted in adulthood. Well, that was a brilliant insight. And it began a whole movement of research on how important our bodies are to our psychology. Now, in my opinion, at least, you know, I studied and have taught Piaget for years. My reading of Piaget, maybe I'm misinformed because of how he was interpreted in the U.S., but my reading of Piaget is that he studied the first 2 years and called that the sensory-motor period of cognitive development. But after that, he ignored it and studied the development of linguistically-based cognition, particularly the development of formal operations, formal logic. And that's fine. That's very important, and I consider him a giant in modern psychology. But more recent research has gone back, in a way, to think more carefully about, well, what's the impact of those first 2 years on us as adults? And the realization has been that our bodies are still really important to our psychology, and that we're still assuming a lot of influence from our bodies. As children grow older, we enter into a language system that has been working with, the language system has been working with embodied experience for millennia. Some of it from other language systems like the Hebrew and the Greek, but then those were translated into our language system. And now we've been influenced by Hebrew emphasis on the heart because it's been incorporated into all of our languages. So that single words and other language forms like idioms have been used to label and come to constitute human life as we now experience it. As mentioned above, the psych heart, the psychological heart, is a metonymy. This is a figure of speech in which a part of a semantic system surrounding our body, my heart hurts, is used to refer to the whole. For example, in the sentence, the White House released a document today, or the Kremlin released a document today. The Kremlin or the White House is a one part of that system that refers to the whole. And so when we use the word heart, we're referring to a physical entity originally, but it actually refers to the whole of our embodied experience in our torso. And because of the nerves that are distributed throughout our torso, and the fact that we're receiving information about what's going on there all the time, we have developed a rich language system that explains the idioms that we find in all of our languages about heart. Does that make sense? You following what I'm saying? I'm trying to explain why everyday language uses the heart all the time. And it's because of our journey from infancy into adulthood, where we're still paying attention to what's going on in our torso. And the fact is, our feelings, we have a lot of feelings associated with the heart. And throughout our chest, we experience intense emotions. Where do you experience anxiety? It's a genuine question. Where? Yes. Okay, in your head. That's common. Headaches,
yes.
Pressure,
migraine
would be,
shoulders,
tension in the shoulders, very common. Sometimes pain, thank you. Where else? Shortness of breath in our lungs, in our chest. When we, the more that our sympathetic nervous system is roused, the more we're sent into fight or flight or freeze mode. And fight or flight has shallow breathing, butterflies in the stomach, we call it, nervous tension, a tightness in our stomach. Sometimes, how about shame? Where do you experience shame? I don't know if you've noticed, I didn't, most of the first 15 years of my life as an adult, Children are not very aware of their bodies unless they're taught this. But I would say that I didn't realize that I deal with anxiety every day until I was about 35, 15 years into early adulthood. About 35, I began to be aware, I think it was a book I read, that I always have a certain amount of anxiety in my stomach that I've carried around with me probably my whole life. My parents had anxiety. They raised me with anxiety. And I carry around a fair amount of anxiety all the time. Over time, the Lord has helped me to work on that. And I pour out my heart to the Lord like water. Every day I try and do that in my devotion time, where I surrender my anxiety to Him. And I've gotten to the point where if you give me 20 minutes, I can pretty much release all the anxiety I carry. Because I practiced it for a while. And I would say all of you could do the same. If you struggle with anxiety or some kind of a dominant negative emotion that you carry around with you, that it's possible to address that in a fairly conscious way. But how does that happen? Well, we have to direct our attention not just on our minds, whereas where we've been taught to keep them. Don't worry about what's going on down there. Just focus on your mental life. And what I'm suggesting, and many psychologists nowadays are also suggesting, is we also need to get into our bodies. And particularly because that's where our emotions are being manifested. This is a process, an eighth sense is called, if you can see this, interoception. So, we're aware of vision, hearing, our senses, for the external world. There's five of them. But we also have some internal bodily senses. One of them is knowing where my body parts are at any given point in time. That's called proprioception. So, basketball players and ballerinas have to have a good proprioception, where they know where their bodies are. Interoception is simply body awareness. And it's a skill that you can develop, that you can become more attuned to if you focus your attention on, what am I feeling right now? So how about if we do that? Let's do what's called a body scan. What I'd like you to do is to just get in a comfortable position with your eyes closed and just kind of go through your body slowly, focusing on, where am I tight or tense? What do I notice is going on in my body, especially my torso? Do you feel restless? Tense? Do you have any pain? Are you still full from breakfast? Anything unusual there? All right, well, let me kind of bring you back. We didn't do a full minute there, but if we want to work on our anxiety level, it helps to notice how tense or tight our muscles are. You know what fidgeting looks like with your foot, jiggling a lot. Well, that's an indicator of an aroused sympathetic nervous system. And it's okay if you do that. I've always had a tendency to be fidgety. But over the years, I've learned how to calm that down by focusing my attention on my muscles in my body and taking a lot more time, which I think we'll do before we're done today, where we'll go through our bodies and we'll deliberately, intentionally relax our muscle tissue. And I'll explain why that's helpful. It turns off the sympathetic nervous system and turns on the parasympathetic nervous system, which lowers our arousal and makes us feel more calm. But I wonder if any of you noticed something that you weren't paying attention to in your chest, in your stomach. I feel some anxiety in my stomach. I usually do when I'm teaching. It's just kind of an intense experience to teach. So this information is happening, this information processing is happening automatically if we're not aware of it. And I would argue that God wants us to become more aware of it in order to become more the Lord of our bodies. He's the ultimate Lord of everything, right? But he wants us to be, to not let things happen to us, but to be responsible for what's going on inside of our bodies and our souls. And so part of that journey, in my opinion, is developing body awareness so that we can manage our body, souls, more thoughtfully, more carefully, in light of all that he's doing in the new creation. And the skill of interoception is a part of that. So these are cognitive linguistic reasons for why it's important for us to take the heart seriously. You see where I'm going? Where is the heart, the psychological heart? We know that the physical heart is here. That's not where the psychological heart is alone. That's a part of it. What would you say? And if you think about the idioms and the way that we use heart in phrases in our language, it includes at least this much of my torso. Now, we also go up against another common term in ancient language and in English, and probably your language as well, the gut. Is there a word for gut in Romanian and some of the other languages here? Gut level experience. In the Greek, it was splankhna, which meant intestines. It's the same thing. And there's always been words associated with psychological experience that's registered in our torso. But that also, in a tertiary degree, in our bodily extremities. And this is where fidgeting occurs, movement of the fingers or of our feet that indicates a restlessness of our hearts that kind of manifests in the extremities.